Welcome to Your Health Today with Good Samaritan Hospital, and I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to talk with Karen Kanzler, who's a nurse, and Good Samaritan Hospital's community outreach nurse and arthritis navigator. And we're talking about Better Health by the Book, which is a book club. Tell us about this.
It is a book club that we are in partnership with Greetings and Readings in Hunt Valley, and I'm very excited. I've always wanted to belong to a book club or go to a book club, but I just haven't found the time, so I decided why not start my own. I am very passionate, and I read a lot of things on good health, especially health with the aging, seeing how I'm, you know, on the far side of a baby boomer myself, and my passion is to help people age vibrantly. We're all supposed to age. I want to bring it back in fashion, but we're not supposed to rot.
What does that mean?
Going to age, and it's something that's kind of frowned upon in our society, and, you know, oh my gosh, a wrinkle, oh my gosh, a waddle's coming up, and all of this kind of stuff. But we're supposed to age. It's supposed to happen to us. We do it from the moment we're born, but our choice is how we feel about it, and we can choose to rot or not to rot. And I want to help people to choose not to rot, have a great attitude, and age vibrantly. I guess my message is we are green and growing and not rotting.
So we're the rock and roll generation, not the rot and roll generation.
Yes, I like that. Well, Uncle, may I use that?
You can use it.
Thank you.
So tell us about this club and what happens at Greetings and Readings and what you're actually doing with all this.
Well, we're going to meet for the first time November 3rd at 7 p.m. at Greetings and Readings in Hunt Valley. And I've chosen my first book. It's called Younger Next Year. And it is written by Dr. Henry Lodge and his patient, Chris Crowley. It is a wonderful new take on exactly what my message is, trying to age vibrantly. Just, you can tell that by the title, Younger Next Year. And it's not about going out and getting tons of surgery done, although I'm not saying I'm against that. But it's about changing your body from the inside out, exercising, everything you can control, your attitude, as well as staying connected, caring about things, and having a lot of passion for something. So we're going to meet on that Tuesday night at 7 o'clock in Greetings and Readings. We'll have some light refreshments. It's a great partnership with the bookstore. It's more than a bookstore. They've got discount coupons to use there. I'm very excited about it, and I hope some more people sign up.
So tell me about what you got from this book. I mean, what came out when you read the book? What were the things that spoke to you the most?
What spoke to me the most was it's the whole attitude, the way it's written. It's from a hysterical point of view that is really funny. It uses metaphors all in there. It talks about our husband that's been around forever as Old Fred and how you better become good friends with Old Fred again since you're going to be spending the rest of the life with him or not. But we hope that you do. They talk about how our body is like the tide, you know, ebbing and flowing. And as you get older, you know, it catches up with you, and you better do whatever you can to try to stay strong and all of those things. It stresses the importance of exercise, and it's just so funny, and it really has a great viewpoint, and I just love the way it's written, and I hope other people do too.
Now, what I understand is that these personal mantras from this book, like grow your physical brain, don't get survival dependent, care, connect, commit.
Yes, care, connect, commit. That's my favorite
thing.
That's
yours.
That's my favorite thing. Find something you love and be passionate about it and do what you can to make changes. Make a commitment to yourself to be healthy and to age vitally. And connect with people. You have to stay connected with people as we age. So it's more than just your physical body. It's the social aspect. It's the physical aspect. It's your good attitude. It's everything. Aging is a lot of things. It's more than just the physical changes in your body. It's all of those things.
So Better Health by the Book really is it's a book club where people wrestle with books in a very kind of fun way to kind of figure out how to stay healthy as we age.
How to stay healthy and vibrant as we age. And we're not just going to talk about books, period. There's tons of things written out there. Journal articles, magazines. I mean, that's going to be open for discussion after the first night, but this is the book I want to start with, and I'm so excited about it.
Karen Kanzler, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Your Health Today with Good Samaritan Hospital, proud member MedStar Health. You can learn more about Better Health by the Book by calling 443-444-4100 or go to goodsam-md.org to register for Better Health by the Book. You'll also get a discount coupon to use at Greetings and Readings in Hunt Valley, where this will be held. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are about to begin the heart of our first hour today to talk about race. This is part of an ongoing series that Open Society Institute Baltimore is conducting in our community. It's the fourth in a series of talking about race. It'll be held tomorrow night, Monday night, at 7 p.m., Monday, November 2nd, at Enoch Pratt Library in the Wheeler Auditorium. And today we're going to talk about that fourth in the series with the two people who will be presenting on Monday night. We are privileged to have both these people with us. Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum is Spelman College's president. She's author of the book that kind of many people really grabbed a hold of, Why Are All Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? She's also written Can We Talk About Race and Other Conversations in an Era of School Resegregation. Dr. David Hornbeck is with us as well. He, for 12 years, was superintendent of the Maryland school system and a former Philadelphia superintendent of schools as well, and author of the book Choosing Excellence in Public Schools, Where There's a Will, There's a Way. And Beverly Daniel Tatum and David Hornbeck, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. 410-319-8888. Log on to the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. Join the conversation there or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, and we will bring your thoughts to the airwaves that way. Each one of these conversations taking place has been a little different. And this one actually is kind of really exciting because I think it touches into some core of reality that we're facing. One of the things is you both, let me take a step back 20 years, 25 years maybe a little bit more, depending on who we're talking to. Because often one of the things about conversations about race, people always remember, and you've written about this, Beverly Daniel Tatum, people always remember their first conversations about race, their first intersection with issues of race.
Yes.
So talk about that idea and talk about yours.
Well, you know, one of the things that I used to do when I was leading workshops, I would often ask people to reflect on their earliest race-related memory. It didn't necessarily have to be something negative, but just something that was specifically race-related. And one of the things that you'll find is that people of color tend to have very early memories. White people tend to have memories that happen a little bit later in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so my earliest memory goes back to being 3 years old, actually, having a conversation with a playmate who said I was black. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm tan. And for your listeners, I will tell them that I am a light-skinned African-American woman. And so tan is probably a better description in terms of, you know, color coding than the word black. But it was, we got into an argument, my three-year-old friend and I, about this. And when I reflect on it, I will tell you that this was in the late 50s, this conversation. I was born in 1954, so this was probably 1957. And, you know, we were both right in that sense. You know, he was right in that if we think of black as a term for African-Americans, I'm certainly African-American. But if you think about it in, you know, a three-year-old's mind, you know, tan was a better description.
Was your three-year-old friend black or white?
Oh, my three-year-old friend was also black.
Okay, yeah.
And so we were having this conversation, but it, when I reflect on it as an adult, one of the things that I remember about it was that it probably symbolizes an understanding, even at the age of three in 1957, that it wasn't such a good thing to be black. And so it was important to be right on this point. And, you know, when I tell that story to adult audiences, you know, it's often triggers other kinds of memories that people will have. But when I fast forward to my adulthood, I think about having conversations with my own children. I have two sons who are now in their 20s, but when my oldest son was about 4 years old, we had a similar conversation where he came home from preschool and said, you know, so-and-so said, I'm black. Am I black? And I said, well, yes, you are. And he said, no, I'm not. It was sort of another generational version of that conversation.
You know, I think that's an interesting, I mean, it's interesting because when you say that, it makes me flash back on my two oldest girls. They had the same thing. They didn't call themselves black until they almost got to junior high school. Till they got to middle school.
Yeah.
They would always go, No, I'm tan.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
No, it's an interesting phenomenon. David Hornbeck.
Well,
Go ahead, Beverly. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, it just also reflects that it takes children a while to come to have an understanding of what race means in our society, and that often isn't until they really are adolescents that they really start to know what these terms mean and the implications of them in terms of our social structures.
That's true. David Hornbeck.
I'm going to prove Dr. Tatum's point
about okay.
the distinction between when African Americans remember their first experience and whites do. I'm white. I didn't have the first really stark memory until the fall that I was a freshman in college. So I was 14 years delayed in that process compared to Dr. Tatum. And my experience at that time was realizing one day after about 2 weeks there that the custodian in my dorm, we all called Henry, and the custodian in the student union building, we all called Mr. Jones. And it just hit me one day that the only distinction between the two was not their job, nothing other than their race. And that was one of the very early, really pounding instances in my own experience, because I grew up in the 40s and 50s and went to segregated schools. And in fact, until I went to seminary, never went to school with someone of color.
But you grew up in East Texas, right?
Yes.
And so did you, and East Texas was, as we talked about earlier, East Texas, before you went there, East Texas was the Deep South during the days. I mean, it is the Deep South.
Same as Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia.
Louisiana, that's it. But were there no black folks in your town?
No, there were substantial numbers, but they were invisible in a sense to the world that I lived in. We didn't see one another in school. We didn't see one another in church. We didn't see one another in the stores. And lots of white people then and today, I think it's fair to say, find themselves on third base, as they say, think they've hit a triple when in fact they were born there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the product of white privilege, and so that invisibility continues.
Speaking of white privilege, Beverly Daniel Tatum, I've read all your works, and I just think you're one of our – I'm not blowing smoke here. I just think you're one of our most important thinkers on the issue of race, because you really have a nuanced – thinking when it comes to everything, at least it seems to me.
Well, thank you.
And I wish would you talk a bit about your sense of what white privilege means, and especially this idea you have about what it means to the most important thing maybe is to kind of end up fighting racism. Well, let me take one step at a time. Just talk a bit about this notion of white privilege and how you look at it.
Sure. Well, the term white privilege is often used to describe the benefits, or when we talk about racial privilege, we could talk about other kinds of privilege privilege associated with gender or with class or with religion. But when we think about racial privilege, we typically are thinking about the benefits that are associated with being white in a society where white people have had the advantage. And so these benefits are not always even conscious to the people who receive them. They may include things like the example that was just offered, you know, being referred to as Mr. Jones instead of by your first name, you know, being afforded a certain kind of respect simply because you are a white person, being able to travel without being concerned about, you know, will I be stopped by the police while I'm driving, or, you know, the kinds of things that people of color often talk about, not being a part of the daily experience that a white person has. They're all kind, you know, being able to look for an apartment without being worried that you might be discriminated against, or being able to assume that if your children go to school, that they will have teachers who think well of them. You know, there are all kinds of things that if you are a member of the dominant group, you just take for granted, but that people who've had a history of discrimination and experience with daily prejudice have not necessarily been able to assume.
But you also have written about the idea that and most people don't know talk about this. You want people to feel good about who they are.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether that being black or white or Mexican, whatever that is.
Yes.
And that at the same time, if you're white in America, you don't think about being white because you don't have to.
Yes. You know, sometimes I use as an example the fact that we all have multiple identities. And so I identify as a woman. I identify as African American. I identify as a Christian. I grew up in a middle class family. There are things about me that are part of my identity, and some of those things give me advantage. My class background, my religious background, advantage me in our society. But some things can be a disadvantage. My racial group membership, my gender can be. In those areas where I am part of the majority, I am a physically capable person, I don't have any disabilities. When I walk into a building with stairs, I don't necessarily think, oh, a person in a wheelchair wouldn't be able to get into this building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just take for granted that I can enter and I don't think twice about it, unless perhaps I'm accompanied by somebody who is has a mobility impairment. So in the same way, when we think about racial privilege, it is not necessarily the fact that someone has it that should be their source of pain, but the fact that you have it does mean that you are in a position of power to advocate for others who may not share that privilege. You know, to use my able-bodied example, I may not be barred by those stairs, but I need to be thinking about, you know, the others who might come behind me. Is there wheelchair access to this building? In the same way, when someone who has racial privileges recognizes a difference in treatment, the example that David offered, you know, to say, you know, maybe we ought to call Henry Mr. whatever his last name was, Mr. Smith, let's say,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you can use your privilege to be an ally to those who are not benefiting from that same privilege in a way that is a source of pride and allows you to people to feel good about it, you know, working to achieve equity for everyone.
That's important to do strategically also, because sometimes if one hears only from the person for whom one seeks benefit, then the perception is that the person is advocating only in self-interest.
Yeah.
Whereas the person who is the dominant person in the situation, whether with disabilities or race or whatever, there is at least the perception of a measure of the interest only being on behalf of the other, not of oneself.
Exactly.
We're talking about race here on the Mark Steiner Show today, and it's part of a series that OSI Baltimore is doing. There'll be a live program this Monday night, November 2nd, at the Enoch Pratt Free Library at 7 p.m. with both of our guests, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, who's president of Spelman College and who's written the books Why Are All Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And most recent one, Can We Talk About Race? Dr. David Hornbeck, who's a former Maryland State Superintendent of Schools and also the Philadelphia Superintendent of Schools, formerly, and wrote the book Excellence in Public Schools, Where There's a Will, There's a Way. The lines are open to 410-319-8888. Something stimulates you in this conversation. We'd love to hear your thoughts as we kind of explore the issue of race on different levels here. 410-319-8888. Maybe you have your own stories about when you first were aware of race in your life. 410-319-8888. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com, and we'll come to your calls in a few minutes. We're in a place in America where sometimes people talk about race is either overdone. Some people say it's overdue. Some say it's already been done. So I'm curious where you think we are with all that right now, because we had legalized segregation. We never really had integration, though we've had periods of integration in some schools. And in many ways, we are resegregated now. And oftentimes, the only time people interact cross-racially is at work, not in their neighborhoods, not in their churches or synagogues or mosques or temples. You know, not in recreation so much, but usually at work. Where do you think we are with that now? Let me start again with Beverly Tatum and then go to David Hornbeck.
Well, I think we are certainly in a different place than we were 20, 30, 40 years ago in terms of social interaction. I grew up in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Sometimes I like to tell the story of I was born in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I've already mentioned I was born in 1954. Florida was a very segregated state at that time. My father was a professor teaching at Florida A&M, which is a historically black college, or historically black university, and He wanted to pursue his doctorate at Florida State University in 1954 and was unable to attend Florida State because at the time it was still segregated. The state of Florida paid my father's transportation to Pennsylvania so that he could attend Pennsylvania State University, which is where he earned his doctorate. That was the state's solution to the order to integrate. Rather than to integrate the graduate programs, they simply sent the African-American graduate students north. So when we hear, when I tell that story, you know, it seems like such a ridiculous thing today. And, of course, Florida State University is well integrated, has, you know, a very diverse student population, and I've been a speaker there at Florida State. So when we think about, you know, the not that long ago past, it's we're living in quite a different time. But in the on the other hand, we find ourselves in a situation where public education is more segregated today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. So that children, you know, going to elementary schools today, going to middle schools today, are very likely to be in very homogeneous, racially homogeneous learning environments, more so than, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago. And as a consequence, they're not having the opportunity to have direct contact in a meaningful way with young people their own age, unless they're in a neighborhood that is diverse or involved in out-of-school activities that are diverse. But typically, that's not the case, because the main reason our schools are segregated is because we are operating with neighborhood schooling more than we did in the past, and those neighborhoods are still segregated. Mm-hmm.
David?
If I had to choose between your three artfully chosen categories, which I think are well said, I would fall into the overdue category while acknowledging the significant differences between the period when I grew up and today, and through a long line of people of which Dr. Tatum, of whom Dr. Tatum is a part. I mean, the dialogue that Dr. Gates and Cornel West had, the kind of dialogue that President Clinton tried to provoke with Chris Edley leading the charge, the Philly speech that President Obama made, the fact that we've had now, this will be the fourth of these conversations here. So lots of good things have gone on. But I must say that in the world of practical, in practical terms, when I think of a 50% dropout rate, largely African-Americans, something close to that in Baltimore City and in most many other big cities, and the fact that 90% plus of Head Start eligible three-year-olds in the United States don't have those opportunities, and those are disproportionately kids of color. That's why I fall into the overdue category, because conversation is in part, in my judgment, action. And we're clearly missing on so many fronts the action piece.
Let me open the phone, 410-319-8888. Some folks are calling in. Let them join this conversation with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, president of Spelman College, and David Hornbeck, a former superintendent of Philadelphia Schools, 410-319-8888. David, you're on the air.
Hey, how's everybody doing this evening?
Well, how are you?
Good, good. You know, good to hear somebody still keeping the conversation going. I think it's something that really needs to be done on a daily basis because it's a situation that has not been solved or adequately resolved. I guess the problem that I usually have is that I don't even really feel that there's any equality, because institutionally there's set this, you know, there's been this system of inequality. I mean, there's really only three choices: that we assimilate to it, we choose not to assimilate to it, or we actually take some sort of action against it. Either way, it really leaves people who are under the thumb of racism in a unequal or a disproportionate position.
Dr. Tatum? Dr. Tatum?
Yes?
I'm sorry, did you want to respond to David?
Certainly, I wanted to agree that the conversation is overdue, and I also wanted to underscore the point that conversation does indeed lead to action. You know, sometimes people say, well, you know, so-called talk is cheap. You hear that expression sometimes, but In fact, it is through the dialogue, I think, that people deepen their understanding of what the issues are and are then motivated in an ideal world, and certainly I've seen many examples of it in my life, motivated then to take action in ways that lead to better educational opportunity, better economic opportunity. But certainly the work still remains to be done. There's more to do. And so I would certainly agree about that overdue need.
And in many ways it is overdue. I guess one of the questions that I think people ask over and over again when you have dialogues and conversations about race are, to what end? Do you know? I mean, sometimes I think that when you look at diversity programs and diversity mm-hmm. conversations, some of them are kind of always run by what I would consider like kind of, I don't know, dialogue shysters. I mean, you know, that they take us nowhere.
Yeah.
It exercises people out. So, I mean, so to what end is the question? And then where do conversations really take us? And how do conversations get us there, or is kind of a reordering somehow of how we live and work take us there?
Well, if I could respond to that, I think
sure.
that I'm going to use an example. In educational settings, it's very common for schools and universities around the country, but K through 12 in particular, to do professional development with teachers, to do diversity, so-called diversity training, and it might be a one-day workshop. And at the end of the workshop, people may feel excited and feel like it was, you know, very well facilitated, but it doesn't necessarily lead them to the next step in terms of really, you know, revising curricula or really thinking about how to create more equitable classrooms or raise expectations or, you know, create the kind of excellence that David Hornbeck is talking about in his book. And so that one-shot experience is not enough. But on the other hand, I know school districts where they've said, okay, let's have an extended conversation. Let's bring teachers together to talk, not just today, not just, you know, once a semester, but in an ongoing way where we can talk about our classroom practice, where we can think about how we're responding to the needs of children, how we're dealing with parents, in a way that facilitates deepening understanding, but also change in actual classroom practice and behavior. And in those settings where the conversation is sustained and supported, even when it gets difficult, because, you know, one of the reasons we don't talk about race is because it is uncomfortable. But mm-hmm. if we push past that discomfort to get to really the heart of the matter, recognizing that we don't all have the same perspective but willing to engage with each other in mutual respect, you find that people get to a place where they do start to behave differently, start to take action, start to be use the privilege of those who have it, use their privilege to bring about change. And I think it's the sustaining conversations that really lead to the kind of action you want to see.
We have to take a very short break. We'll come back to your thoughts, David Hornbeck. Return to the phones at 410-319-8888. Nikki will be our next caller up. And we'll start looking about school resegregation and the implications it has for students of color. We're going to talk about race and testing and our children and how they view that and what happens. And the value of cross-racial friendships, all of that will be part of our conversation in the next half an hour. Reminding you that Urbanite Radio stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Marin Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 or go to bsomusic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We are talking about race and a continuing conversation about Can We Talk About Race, put on by Open Society Institute Baltimore. This is the fourth in a series of conversations. This Monday night, our two guests today, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tidham, who is president of Spelman College, and Dr. David Hornbeck, former Philadelphia Superintendent of Schools, will be speaking at the Enoch Pratt Free Library Wheeler Auditorium at 7 p.m. Right down in the main branch of the Enoch Pratt Library. We're having that conversation now. The number lines are open here at 410-319-8888. And as I promised, we'll go right to the phones. And Nikki, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Welcome.
My first comment has to do with new media and social media. And observations that I've made, I am a Facebook addict. I admit it. The whole world knows it now. But what I have tried to do is use it constructively. Having President Obama be in his station has, you know, really awakened a lot of opinions. And I try to engage people in dialogue about race, about our president, about politics and everything. What I have found is that among my white friends, the conversations are very tense, are very defensive. They don't tend to have very much openness, and it struck me as interesting because I grew up upper middle class in Montgomery County, very utopian environment of white, Jewish, and black, with a few Latinos and Latinas splintered in there, and race really did not become an issue for me until college, and I'm an African American. Mm-hmm. No one ever called me nigger. I was spending the night in Chevy Chase as much as I was in Silver Spring. So, you know, to see the reactions of my friends who are Republicans, oh my God. And just to try to engage them, it really surprises me because I would think that they would have a level of comfort at the very least with me to engage in these conversations. So my point about the new media is that because it's not anonymous on Facebook, but it is remote. There is not a face associated with it. People are able to communicate with more candor, but that candor isn't always positive and it's not always constructive. And I found that more with whites. So how do we as people, period, white or black, who are able to talk about race constructively, how do we ease people's nerves about talking about it? You know, I've loved this conversation, and a lot of it is, you know, a lot of talk of theory and history and all that. But, you know, this is a problem that I really like to fix, and I really like to fix it on Facebook. So,
Facebook, so that, might be, yep.
Yeah, so that was my first question. My second question is, yep. How do you teach your child about being conscious and proud as a black boy, as my child, as a black boy, as a black girl, and not politicize them? That is my second question.
Those are two really good questions. So let's see if we can wrestle with those two things for a few minutes. Who'd like to begin that? Dave, why don't you start, then we'll go to Beverly Tatum.
Well, I think there are a number of ways of responding. I would shorthand it to say on both questions that the principal ways to accomplish it are through practice and engagement. There's no substitute for doing it. You can't just think about having a conversation about race and become comfortable in the process, although it helps a little bit to have given a thought or two to it. But it's the actual engagement and seeking out friendship, or if not friendship, at least acquaintance, and being willing to step out there. I think the same thing is true with one's child. I think that this recent, I guess it was Newsweek article, "Is Your Baby a Racist?" I think was the cover title, made the point that if parents, and I think this was speaking, in my judgment, to white parents, wait until a kid is 12 or 15 or never, to begin to have conversations even with your child about race so that the child can begin to practice and understand engagement and relationships. It's engagement, relationships, and practice that I think is at the heart of the two questions that Nikki raises.
Beverly Tatum?
Well, I'm going to start with the child question first.
Fine.
We'll take this moment to say that there's a long chapter in my book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria, that deals with young children and how they come to understand race. And whether you are the parent of young African-American men, as I am, and certainly they were young children and we had lots of conversations, or whether you are parenting white children or other children of color, I think there are many opportunities. Kids ask questions. You know, children notice difference. They comment on it at a very young age. Three-year-olds, four-year-olds will notice people's differences in terms of size and skin color, hair texture, et cetera. They'll ask those questions. And it is perfectly appropriate for parents to respond in a casual way. One of the things that I used to do when my children were small was to try to, of course, wanting to reinforce a positive sense of their identity as young African-American boys, you know, looking at picture books, providing images that reflected positively on who they were as young children, but also, you know, talking about how much I appreciated the texture of their hair, talking about how much how handsome I thought they were, you know, those kinds of things. But then reinforcing that with images and pictures and exposing them to role models and all of that was part of that. But there were times when my children asked me questions that were uncomfortable. I tell a story in my book about my youngest son asking me at a daycare center when we saw a mother, a biracial family. The mother was white, the child was of color, and my 3-year-old son said, "Mommy, why don't they match?" And I said to him, "They don't have to match." And, you know, and then I said, you know, people come in all different sizes. They don't have to, you know, people don't, mothers and children don't always have to look alike. You know, we match, but that doesn't mean everybody has to match, you know, but having that kind of a conversation. Or, you know, I remember cooking. This is a simple thing, but cooking with my older son, he was about 4 or 5. And we had a dozen eggs, some white eggs, and I was using the last of those white eggs. The next dozen eggs were brown. And so he noticed that, you know, that one egg was white, another egg was brown, and commented about that. And I said, "Yes, and look, they're just like people. They look different on the outside, but we crack them open. They're the same on the inside."
I like, you know, that.
Neat story.
I like it, that.
You know, these are very easy conversations to have if you're thinking about it and, as you know, David said, anticipating it. And sometimes you get caught off guard, but I think even if you don't have the response you wish you had, you can always come back to it the next day and say, you know, yesterday we were talking about such and such, and, you know, you asked me this question, and, you know, I was thinking about it, and here's what I'd like to tell you about that. I think that it's having the dialogue that is most critical and not retreating into silence.
Well, I want to get into our school situation here. I mean, that's part of what you're going to be talking about on Monday. But I want to back into it here this way. One of the things that you've done, Beverly Daniel Tatum, that is controversial because there are a number of people who think it's not important, and very seriously think it's not important, not in a hateful way, but they just do. And given the nature of American society, you look at both the complexity of and the importance of and the dynamic of cross-racial friendships and relationships. You see power in that. And that's not a universally held belief.
Well, I think there's power in relationships across differences of all kinds. But whether you think they're important or not, the reality is we live in a society where we're constantly interacting with people different from ourselves. Even though our neighborhoods may still be socially segregated, even though the public schools, as we were talking about, may still be socially segregated, in the workplace, adults typically are engaging with people who look different from themselves, at least some of the time. And in the course of those interactions, if you work in a place over time, you're going to get to know people, you're going to develop friendships, or you have the opportunity to do that. And I think to the extent that we allow those relationships to develop, one of the benefits is that we come to understand other people's perspectives, which strengthens who we are as individuals and allows us to interact much more effectively with people different from ourselves if we've had a chance to think about something from another person's point of view.
So where do we go here, the two of you in America now, where our schools, the basic institution that where our children spend most of their time, other than their family, are resegregated, are really divided by race for the most part, and in significant ways. In Baltimore here, there was a heyday of integration in some city schools for 1961-2 up until maybe 1969 or so. Then it resegregated again. So where does that take our students, and what does it mean for especially children of color, not just children of color, but any child, really? They were living in this world of segregated schools.
I have a couple things to say about it, and I'm sure that Dr. Hornbeck does.
I'm sure.
But let me just say this, that I think that there's value for young children, for all of us to have an opportunity to interact in diverse settings. But whether or not the schools are segregated or integrated, at the core, we want children to have a high-quality education, to be able to read, write, do quantitative reasoning, you know, to have the tools they need to be successful. And when we think about the history of school desegregation, at the core, the effort to desegregate schools was about access to high-quality education. You know, those African-Americans who labored to get their children into what were predominantly white schools were seeking educational opportunity because of the resources in those schools. It wasn't only about, you know, I want my child to have the opportunity to engage with white children. It was, I want my children to have the opportunities, the educational opportunities that are being afforded those children. And so I think that when we think about what's happening in schools, at the core we have to focus on is the educational experience a high-quality one? Are children really being given the opportunity to achieve excellence? At the same time, if part of what it means to be a citizen of the 21st century is being able to engage with people different from yourself, not just in terms of the racial terms that we're talking about now, but really thinking globally, then we have the opportunity to think about the new media that your caller talked about, you know, the various ways technology can help us bridge differences. Here at Spelman College, we are a historically black college for women, but our students have lots of opportunities to engage with people outside the gates of Spelman in the internships they do and the global travel they experience, even in the technology we use, you know, conversing with students around the world through video technology and other means. So I think it's not an either or, but at the bottom line for every student is getting an excellent education.
I totally agree with Dr. Tatum, of course, and let me just make two or three underlined points. One is an African-American child need not sit next to a white child in order to have a really first-rate education. The great benefit, you asked a little earlier, what's the benefit of having a conversation? And much of that is the action that can flow from it. But I think we have to keep coming back to the fact that relationships and conversations enrich the soul of a human being. And the richer those are and the variety of opportunities that exist makes it a good in and of itself. Third thing I would say is that in order to create greater levels of integration, it won't in the end come, in my judgment, as a consequence of magnet school programs and some of the other strategies that we've used. It's going to come in large measure because we create really good schools where kids want to go, whether they're African American or whether they're white. Both of my boys are principals in Baltimore City Schools. Both now have waiting lists to get in. And they actually have seen an increase in the proportion of white kids coming into their schools since those schools got better and better. And I don't think that's an accident. And what's happened as a result is that the schools themselves have gotten better, and all the kids, whether they're African American or white, or in the case of one of those two schools, largely Latino, are better as a consequence. Kids can read better. They can do math better. They can take the next appropriate step in their education. So the real focus in my mind ought to be on making sure that the school is high quality. And we have to remember, too, a little number, and Dr. Tatum, correct me if I get this off by a percentage point or two, but if present population trends continue, by the time my oldest grandchild is 30, and that's amazingly now for me, only about 17 years away, a majority of the school kids in America will be kids of color.
Yeah.
Right.
And by the time she's 50, a majority of the United States is going to be a population of color. And so even if you don't believe that it enriches the soul to have a conversation and make this different and better for kids in education. If you want to make sure that all the folks who are counting your pills in the old folks' home, as they say, are getting it right, we better get this better than we've been doing right now. So there's a very pragmatic reason, even in addition to the relationship reason.
We're talking about race here on the Mark Steiner Show as part of the continuing conversation we have on this program, but specifically this hour is part of the conversation created by the Open Society Institute Baltimore. It's fourth conversation about race, and the conversation will be, can we talk about how race affects our classrooms, will be held this Monday night with our two guests. It'll be Monday night at Enoch Pratt Free Library, 7 p.m. on Monday, in the Wheeler Auditorium on Cathedral Street. And both Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, president of Spelman College, and Dr. David Hornbeck, former Philadelphia school superintendent, will be on that panel. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go right to the phones again. And T, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi, T.
Thank
welcome.
You so much for your conversation. I was just listening to Dr. Hornbeck, and it was exactly what I wanted to speak about. I have a six-year-old son, and I'm African-American. I grew up in Harford County, which is largely diverse, and I appreciated the fact that in the schools that the diversity was a good thing. I believe right now I live on the west side of Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm.
However, I chose to look for a school for my son that was more diverse than what was on the west side of Baltimore City. I've gotten a lot of flack from my neighbors for it because I actually take my son out of zone. He goes to a charter school, Hampstead Hill Academy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and but I see the tremendous benefit of taking him to that school. Because of that diverse, it's very diverse. There's Latinos, there's whites, there's African-Americans. And I know that as myself growing up in a diverse neighborhood, that it was very beneficial. My husband grew up, born and raised in Baltimore, but he agreed that we wanted to make sure that our son got to see the world. He got to see that there's more than just what's in his neighborhood. And the way we saw to be able to do that was, if we could, if possible, is to find a school that was diverse. And he was doing his homework one night, and it was one of the coloring projects, and the color of, there were children on the picture, and he could choose whatever color he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the children on the picture was visibly not African American and not white, and so he went through his Crayola colors, his 64 Crayola colors, to find the correct color, and he found apricot. So he began to use the color apricot. That's actually the term he uses for a lot of the Latino kids in his school.
Apricot.
Yeah, apricot, because that's the only color he could find that matched. But that is a payoff for me, is that he's seeing that there are diversities and that everybody's a different color, but he accepts himself as different. He'll say, you know, he's a brown boy like me,
mm-hmm.
or she's a white girl like me, or she's apricot. And that, for that age, I think it's really good, but it opens up the dialogue for when he has more serious questions as he gets older.
The issues you're raising here are important, and if you don't mind, I'd like to leap off from what you said and come back to something that we talked about a minute ago.
Oh, no problem.
No, because it's a really important example, and Hampstead Hill's an incredible school.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love it.
Incredible school. We've talked to the principal there many times and had him on the air here with us.
Yes, absolutely.
But I want to go back to, again, the importance of, in a heterogeneous society like ours that has wrestled with segregation, slavery, annihilating Native Americans, excluding Chinese from this country for a long time, thinking of Italians, Jews, and before that, Irish is not even white when they first got here. That was all part of this country. And then I look at places like Sarajevo, and I look at places like Baghdad, and I look at communities like what happened in Wayomo in Uganda. I mean, in Rwanda, and in societies where cosmopolitan, where people crossed ethnic lines and intermarried, that something exploded and set people off against one another, even in the most cosmopolitan areas. So I want to talk about how you think it works in the most heterogeneous society on the planet Earth, United States of America, and if we even have a chance of getting to a place in America that goes beyond just having conversations about race, if in fact there's not a way to take T's children's experience or my children's experience and putting them into a multiracial world if we're going to survive. I mean, because we can have all the dialogue we want, but if we remain, in the end, it still remain separated, then where do we go? Beverly Daniel Tatum.
Well, I think that your question is a very important one, which is to say, how do we, as a society in the United States, how do we build a society where we can truly say we are operating as one? Not that we all agree or have the same political ideologies or that kind of thing, but that we are really able to understand and recognize that we are all in this boat together, you know, to paraphrase Dr. King, you know, that we will all succeed or fail together. And that is, I think, the challenge of the 21st century. Certainly, we see that we are part of a global society, that as a country, we have to be able to perform at our best if we are able to compete internationally with the world around us. And that requires us to be able to invest and care about one another's success within the boundaries of our society, but even beyond, you know, ultimately we're part of a global community, not just a national one. But at the same time, I think we can point to signs of hope. And I would point to the election of Barack Obama, President Obama, as one example of that. I mean, there are a lot of people who did not believe the United States would elect an African-American president. And however people may feel today about that decision, you know, whether they are in supportive of what the president is doing or not, the fact that that election took place, you know, a year ago was a sign of a really positive development in our society. Many people thought that, you know, even though people said they were going to vote, that they wouldn't actually do it in the booth when they got there because they wouldn't be able to pull that switch for an African-American man, but in fact, they did. And so it suggests that we are a society capable of changing. And so given that, I think that the more of us are having this dialogue and talking about what it is that is required for us to engage with one another in a civil way, and as we think about what's happening in our society right now, it's the lack of civility that I think is really threatening the society. And sometimes that lack of civility travels in race-related clothing. Sometimes it doesn't. But right. I think it is really important for all of us to say, you know, we are going to rise or fall together.
We have about 30, I'm sorry. Dave, we have about 30 seconds if you want to.
Well, let me just quickly say that the good news is that the technical answers to educational challenges exist. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not the political resolve, the public will exists to insist that public policy create school systems that are going to work. I'm hopeful because of the president's election. I want to see what happens with the health care stuff. When education gets traction, I hope that all of us pull together to make what he wants to have happen, happen.
Dr. David Hornbeck, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, thank you both so much for being with us tonight. It's been a pleasure to have you in this conversation.
Thank you so much.
I look forward to meeting you on Monday, Dr. Tatum, and I encourage you all this Monday to go to the Enoch Pratt Library at 7 p.m. Monday, November 2nd, Enoch Pratt Free Library, Wheeler Auditorium on Cathedral Street for the fourth in the series Talking About Race from OSI Baltimore. This conversation is Can We Talk About How Race Affects Our Classrooms? The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite explains a new movement in architecture and design, debates the downsizing of Baltimore City, and offers an in-depth look at behind the state's biggest transportation project. It's the building issue. And it's available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back to continue our show and meet some real Ghostbusters who chase ghosts. Find out what that's about when we return.